So I want to, first of all, express my appreciation and admiration for those of you who have stuck it out this long. It's been an intense day. The question that we have before us is this. Can Judaism be distilled into a single concept or a single word? Can we find some kind of, pivot, right, to a fulcrum upon which a lever to move the universe of Judaism? Elliot just said, my doctoral dissertation was written on the thought of a thinker by the name of Eliezer Berkowitz, who was really fascinating and covered a whole broad range of Jewish philosophy. He actually wrote 19 different books, but I'm going to get to his biography in a minute. The point is that he really tried to build a modern, applicable, relevant philosophy of Judaism that simultaneously, on the one hand, preserves the essences of Jewish traditional life and thinking and instincts, and on the other hand, really, really addresses the questions that that modernity, which Francis raised a number of times, the issues of modernity. He takes these questions head on. He does not dismiss them. He takes them seriously. He engages with modern life in a way that very, very few traditional Jewish philosophers did. And he really, I believe, did try to boil it down, or at least I tried in analyzing his thinking to try to boil it down into some kind of a coherent whole. Just a couple of words about Eliezer Berkowitz. He was born in 1908 in Oradea, which was really the center of Jewish life in Transylvania, which is now Romania at the time. He was born to a very Zionist family. But Oradea, by the way, was a city with a thriving, what today we call Reform, as well as Orthodox congregations. So he was Orthodox, but he was not cut off from the more modern or progressive or whatever you would call them, non-Orthodox developments. He studied first at the Yeshiva of Pressburg and then later in the 1930s at the Rabbinical Seminary in Berlin, also known as the Hildesheimer Yeshiva. His teacher, he was the top student of Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg, also known as the Sri De'esh. And just on a personal note, my rabbinic studies were done with, I mentioned Rabbi Yitzhak Lifshitz in this morning's talk. Rabbi Lifshitz's father, who just passed away a week ago, Rav Chaim Lifshitz, or 2 weeks ago, also studied under Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg after the war in Switzerland. So it was on the one hand, an interesting coincidence, on the other hand, not at all surprising to discover that we're coming from a very similar school of thought rabbinically. At the same time, Berkowitz did a doctorate in philosophy at the University of Berlin on the thought of David Hume. He left Berlin in 1939, went to England, went to London. His own library was destroyed in the Blitz, but the works of Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg, which he carried with him everywhere he went, were saved from the destructions of war. That's why the book that was eventually published was called The Sri De'esh, the survivor of the fire. During the war, very soon after London, he spent a very short time in London and went up to Leeds, where he had a pulpit, and his wartime sermons were later published as a book called Between Yesterday and Tomorrow. Fascinating, fascinating collection of sermons in which a very worldly rabbi draws some very interesting parallels between the people of England during the Battle of Britain and the Jewish people facing the same enemy from a different side of Europe and with, unfortunately, very different outcome. He went from there to Sydney, Australia, to the neighborhood of Roxbury in Boston, and ultimately to Skokie, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago, where he really sort of found his place for nearly 20 years where he was the head of the Department of Philosophy at the Hebrew Theological College in Skokie, and also the founder, the founding rabbi, unofficial rabbi of the Or Torah Synagogue. I say unofficial rabbi because he refused to be the rabbi. He was the posek. He was the person they asked questions to. He was the person who made the decisions on ritual. But he nonetheless insisted on sitting in the back and on the front and on putting away the chairs together with everybody else. And he simply could not accept the position of rabbi as something that he wanted to be. He felt that his wisdom should stand on its own accord. And if people wanted to ask him questions because they thought he was could help, then he would help. During this time, he wrote a lot of books. He wrote 19 books in all. Books covering, the first two were in German. The majority were in English. A couple were in Hebrew. One was in modern Hebrew, and two were in yeshiva Hebrew. And as a whole, he addressed every question that was on the table of Jewish life. There was the Holocaust, and there was the issue of theology of the Holocaust. He was there. Questions of Zionism and Judaism, he was there. Development of halakha, the role of women, he was there. He wrote an entire book refuting Arnold Toynbee's characterization of the Jews. In other essays, he took on the theoretized drug culture of people like Timothy Leary and Aldous Huxley. Whereas in other essays, he's dealing with the inner issues of halakha. Questions. He has an entire book on causality in halakha, and another book on divorce and conditionality in divorces in halakha. His last few books deal with modern problems, such as what has happened to the kibbutz movement and what's going to happen to women in Judaism. In 1975, he made Aliyah. Lived in Jerusalem until his death in 1992. Here goes. I'm going to touch on three specific topics in his writing. But what I'd like to do first is just to say that overall, Berkowitz developed an explanation of Judaism that was dedicated to the idea of human responsibility. Okay? He wrote several of his books, by the way, in addition to what I said before. He also wrote books attacking other Jewish thinkers. I forgot to mention this. One major essay attacking Hermann Cohen, a major essay attacking Franz Rosenzweig, another one on Heschel, another one, two on Mordechai Kaplan. But his most important writing, most important were his works of construction. Of constructing Judaism, of explaining what the essence of Judaism is. And the central work, for those of you keeping score at home, the most important work was a rather short book called God, Man, and History, which appeared in 1959 first, and which I had the honor of overseeing the republication of it in 2004. The concept of responsibility, I believe, is the turning point. The idea that man was put on this earth in order to take care of it. That Adam was put in the Garden of Eden to work it and to keep it, as the text says. And that we too are put in this world in order to make it better. I'm going to focus on three specific areas that he wrote about as sort of test cases of how his thinking works and of how he reached the conclusions he reached. The area of morality and halakha, the area of sovereignty and Zionism, and the area of Holocaust and theodicy and the meaning of evil. One of the most striking things, the central book that he wrote on morality and halakha is called Not in Heaven, The Nature and Function of Jewish Law. The Hebrew edition is called Halakha Kocha V'Tafkida, and the Hebrew version is sort of yeshivish and broader, and more appropriate for learning in a Beit Midrash, whereas the English version is more readable. as was to learnable. And one of the most striking things about his take on Jewish law is, first of all, that there are values in it. Okay, the Jewish law is not simply a set of rules. Now, this is an issue of dispute. Okay, there's a debate here. Within Jewish tradition, within rabbinic tradition, and to this very day, there is a debate over whether or not halakha is hierarchical, whether or not halakha is teleological, whether or not it has values that are propelling it forward, that you have to understand and have to internalize in order to do halakha right. Okay, that debate started thousands of years ago. I have a personal stake in it because it probably started around the time that they stopped saying the Ten Commandments in the temple, in the Beit HaMikdash. They used to say the Ten Commandments as part of the service, and then they stopped. Why did they stop? Because they were afraid that people would focus too much on the Ten Commandments and not enough on the other 603. This question in later centuries expressed itself in the question of ta'amei mitzvot. Do we care about the reasons behind commandments, or do we just do what we got to do? Okay. And Berkovitz took a very strong position. He said that there is a set of values underlying halakha, and that it causes halakha to evolve over time. Okay, now this is very controversial, of course, because Orthodoxy is facing conservative Judaism, which usually, for the most part, put forth the belief that halakha has to change because modern life demands it to change. Conservative Judaism was saying, in the words of one conservative theologian, modern life is the thesis, halakha is the antithesis, they come together and they create a synthesis, and that becomes the thesis for the next generation. Okay, Berkovitz didn't like any of this sort of semi-quasi-Hegelian kind of thesis, antithesis. He basically said no. But on the other hand, just because they're wrong doesn't mean that halakha doesn't evolve. And he went through a series of examples. He says that the most important thing to know, however, is that the Torah has to be applied to life. And it has to be applied to life in a way that works. And the definition of what works is a definition that comes from inside the Torah itself. Okay? The rabbis, he writes, the rabbis in the Talmud were guided by the insight. God forbid that there should be anything in the application of the Torah to the actual life situation that is contrary to the principles of ethics. What are those principles? They are Torah principles, like, and you shall do that which is good and right in the eyes of the Eternal, or all her ways are ways of pleasantness and all her paths are peace, or that you may walk in the way of good men and keep the paths of the righteous. Right? He's quoting Psukim, and he's going through and he's saying there are Torah values. And when those values are being threatened, when those actual values are being threatened in their application in real life by the strictures of the halakha, so the halakha finds a way to get around them in order to advance the values. The most obvious example of this was the prosbul, in which according to the Torah, and we're talking about actual, you know, Doraita Torah laws, which get circumvented by rabbinic invention, okay, in order to advance Torah values. So you have the prosbul in which we have this problem in Jewish law, in the Torah, that every 7 years you have the forgiveness of loans. Right? You lend money to somebody, if he doesn't pay you back by the sabbatical year, that loan is forgiven. The problem, of course, is that 1 year, the closer you get to the sabbatical year, the less likely people are to lend money. And the Torah says, no, don't do that. But what are you going to do? It happens. And in order to get around this, the rabbi instituted a principle called the prosbul, which is a device which essentially takes the loan and puts it into the hands of the community, and therefore it doesn't get forgiven. And only in this way could we successfully continue to encourage giving money to lending money to people. This is only one of a whole string of Torah principles that are advanced by getting around Torah law. Another example appears in the Mishnah. As you know, Pikuach nefesh doche Shabbat. House on fire, you can put out the fire to save lives. Well, what about the following situation? How about you're in, what's the next town over? Sorry?
Hamilton.
You're in Hamilton. And the fire is in Niagara Falls. Okay? And it's Shabbat. And there are no firemen in Niagara Falls because there's so much water. How could there be fires? So you're in the fire department in Hamilton, and it's Shabbat, and you know that if you go to Hamilton, to Niagara Falls, and put out that fire, you're going to be stuck there the rest of Shabbat. So according to the Mishnah, according to the Mishnah, this is just fascinating. You can drive all the way to Niagara Falls. It says this. You can drive all the way to Niagara Falls. Put out the fire and then drive back. Okay? There is no fire anymore. It is a clear violation of Torah law. And yet you can do it. Why can you do it? Because if they don't let you do it, then you're not going to go to Niagara Falls in the first place to put it out because you don't get stuck there for Shabbat. They saw that people were refusing to do the mitzvah of Pikuach Nefesh. They broadened the concept of Pikuach Nefesh to include after the fact in order to make sure that those fires get put out. So creative interpretation and halachic innovation make it possible to apply Jewish values, classic real Torah values, but it means that the law does change and evolve over time. A second principle Berkowitz developed was the idea of that Judaism and Jewish morality is what we call consequentialist. He didn't use this word, but this is what philosophers call it. It's much more interested in the effect of your behavior than on your intentions or than on the purity of the act. Okay, take an example if I have it. Or I don't have it. He contrasted himself with thinkers like Martin Buber and Abraham Joshua Heschel, who focused very, very heavily on the purity of intentions. Okay, they say, you know, what really counts is not how these acts peter out into the world of things. That's what Buber calls it, the outer courtyard. But how pure it is inside your heart when you undertake a religious action. Berkowitz saw things very much the other way. His interest was, what impact do you have on the world through your actions? In an amazing book, which hasn't been reissued, but which should be on everyone's shelf. It's called Man and God, Studies in Biblical Theology, in which Berkowitz takes nine different terms in the Tanakh, tzedek, mishpat, tzedakah, shem Hashem, and does a broad analysis of what that term means. It's his fattest book. It's pink. And in his chapter on justice, on the word mishpat, he says something really fascinating. He says justice in the Tanakh is not about following strict rules and laws. The word mishpat appears to be, quote, an appropriateness determined not by abstract consideration, but by the reality of man's condition and subserving the meaningful preservation of human life. Justice is done not that justice prevail, but that life prevail. It is done out of concern with a concrete situation in which life is endangered and calls for its salvation. This is very similar to what Max Weber called an ethic of responsibility. Now, Weber, the sociologist, discussed in his book, Politics as a Vocation, he talks about politicians. He said that politicians have to follow a different kind of ethics. Don't laugh. Have to follow a different kind of ethics from everybody else. Okay? Because everybody else has ethics, meaning a rule of abstract principles. You don't do this, so I'm not going to do it. Okay? Elected politicians have to account first and foremost and last and only for the outcome of their actions, for how well do they succeed in taking care of their community. Okay, and so if that means that right now at this exact moment they have to be less than fully truthful, if that's really what it takes in order to do what's best for the community that they have been charged with the responsibility of taking care of and protecting and saving, then that's what they got to do. And it's okay. It's really right. It's the only right way to be a politician. So what you end up with is, in Berkowitz's writings, you get a certain sense that there is also an ethic responsibility understood as to being the underlying ethics of Judaism, which is a radical thing to say. But what he's basically saying is, and by the way, I don't know if you've ever encountered this this thing about when you're allowed to lie. The rabbis have this really fascinating Gemara about when you're allowed to lie. The three times you're allowed to lie. Okay, that's the last one. You're allowed to lie when someone asks you how much you've learned and what mesechtas you've learned. You're allowed to falsely claim to not have learned as much as you really have, so you don't look like you're bragging. Yeah, what was the second one? All right, right, of course. Explain. You're allowed to lie when... Oh, you're allowed to lie about the, what, about the food. Right, right, of course. Right, you're allowed to lie about the quality of the food at your host's house. Thank you. Right. And you're also... Right, and also the other way. You're allowed to lie it down so that not everybody goes and pastors them. And the third, of course, is that you're allowed to lie about the bride. Right. No, but I think these are the three dimensions. Of course, there you expand this beyond. This is an expandable Gemara, as most Gemaras are. But you're allowed to lie about the bride, as to say, what do you think about my new bride? Okay, and you're not going to say, well, look, you could have done better. You know, the breath. You know, no, because we're much, much, much more concerned. Even as much as we care, the rabbis care about honesty and integrity, there's a reality, a human reality, to which we are fundamentally responsible. Okay? And that means that we have to recognize Jewish law as a certain kind of an ethical responsibility. And the third thing about Jewish law that he said, which is really quite fascinating, is that he goes very deeply into the difference between the body and the spirit. The question of how Judaism is very, very different from other systems of ethics, because we understand that if you're in the world, and if your responsibility is to what happens in the world, that it's not good enough to have good intentions. It's not good enough to have good ideas. You have to do good actions, and good actions require making your body do stuff. Okay? And bodies don't always do what you tell them to do. So he goes through, you know, if you ask sort of Platonic, ancient Greek, philosophical, what is good? You're going to see a response that says good is having the proper ideas. Okay? And if you ask a medieval Christian thinker what is good, you're going to get the answer that says good is faith. And if you ask an Enlightenment thinker, you know, what is good, you're going to end up with good is reason. And in all of these cases, the fundamental thrust of Western thinking about goodness is it has to do with the things that are other than your body, with your mind or your spirit or your soul. Berkovitz says Judaism doesn't look at it this way. Okay, goodness is all about what you do, and what you do is done with your body. This is how he put it. The spirit itself is powerless. It may act only in union with the vital or material forces in the cosmos. No one has ever accomplished anything merely by contemplating an idea. All conscious action is the result of some form of cooperation between the mind and the body. Matter, whatever its ultimate secret, without the mind is inanity. Mind without matter is at best noble impotence. Okay, he later goes on to say that the spirit, the body is not the prison of the soul the way that Greek philosophy taught, but the opposite. The body is the only way that the soul can actually achieve anything. The body is what frees the soul from the shackles of its impotence. So if that's the case, then part of our fundamental morality is a morality of training the body. Okay, and he goes on to draw parallels to military training. He says, the reason we have halakha, the reason we have law, it's because this is the way you train the body to act good, to act well, to act right in difficult cases. Okay, and he explicitly says that you can't hope to defend your country if you train your soldiers by giving them books on the theories of military of combat. Okay, you can't hope to win a swimming championship by studying swimming techniques in books. Okay, the only way you can achieve and perform is through training. And that's true in morality no less than in anything else. We want to behave right. We need halakha to keep us focused, to keep the material sides of our bodies and our worlds focused on something other than our immediate desires and our immediate needs. So if kashrut seems like something kind of out of left field and not really related to ethics, he says, of course it is. Because you always have the immediate self-control and awareness to know that that even if I feel like doing something, if it's not the right thing to do at that moment, I'm not going to do it. And if it's something that needs to be gotten up and done, I'll recognize that because it's a discipline that I've trained myself to adjust my entire physical reality to a higher order of being. All of these morality and law statements take place within the rubric of we are responsible to impact in the world. But when he went to address the second area we're going to talk about, which is sovereignty and Zionism, all of a sudden this attitude moves from the individual to the collective. The question, of course, that has faced Judaism and Jewish thinkers for the last century is the question of, does Judaism need Zionism? Now, there are two forms of religious Zionism that one may argue are really not they're the most dominant, but not necessarily at all relevant for Berkowitz's thinking. One is the sort of Kochian messianic Zionism, which is kind of a deterministic, vaguely Marxist approach to history that says these wheels are churning whether we like it or not, better get on the right bandwagon. And that later years after Rav Kook included, of course, settling the West Bank and refusing to say the prayer for the state of Israel in Kfar Dorom after the disengagement. That was one move. A very spiritual, very romantic, very powerful, but deterministic approach to the meaning, the messianic meaning of the state of Israel. There's another move, which was very, very secular, called the Mizrahi move. The Mizrahi movement, which later became the National Religious Party, was actually founded at the time of Herzl by Herzl in cooperation with the rabbis, where basically the attitude was, it's a mitzvah to save Jewish life. This will save Jewish life, therefore support the creation of the state of Israel. In that constellation, Jewish life and Jewish identity and Jewish conceiving of sovereignty, nothing's really changed. The state is a tool. It's a really good tool for doing the mitzvah of saving lives. To the extent that it saves Jewish life, you support it. To the extent that it doesn't, you don't. Berkowitz had a very different attitude towards Zionism, one that on the one hand gives the Jewish state tremendous religious meaning, but on the other hand completely avoids the messianism and says, on the contrary, it's entirely possible that we could have another exile and the Jewish state could be destroyed and, there are no guarantees. Okay, but to understand how he gets from where we were before to his conception of Zionism, we need to understand that once you take the attitude that religion is about how you change your small area of life, you recognize that Judaism was always meant originally to be in a world where we have control over our lives, collectively. And the more we have control over our lives, the more holiness we can bring into our lives. Because if you are limited to what I do in shul and what I do with my free time, but there's nothing holy about filling out a tax form, unless there is if you're not cheating on your taxes, I guess. But you understand that certain major segments of your life are not Jewish. Okay, defense policy and economic policy are not in control of Jews, are not being decided within a Jewish context. Then basically you're living a partially Jewish life. And he saw diaspora life as inherently partial, inherently limited. Judaism is not an idealistic or spiritual religion, he writes, but a human one. It is a religion for the whole of man. It aims in relating life in its entirety to God. It is not therefore so much a religion of creed as it is a religion of the deed on earth. The intellect or the soul may be satisfied with the creed, but the whole man may serve God only through the deed. But in order to be, the deed must be effective, and it must be so in the place where it belongs, in the external world, in history. For the deed to be effective, it must not remain the act of an individual, but it must become that of a community. The deed makes history if it is the materialization of the desire and will of a community of people joined together in a common cause. So community existence becomes a necessary locus of Jewish life because that's part of human life. Judaism is about bringing the divine into human life. Not part of it, but all of it. But that means that human life must, that Judaism must expand to include the entirety of human life. And ultimately that includes questions of peoplehood, questions of nationhood, questions of sovereignty. And that's why Judaism began as a religion under sovereign conditions. The question then, of course, becomes, what does such a sovereign nation look like? What does a Jewish people look like? And why a people? Why a country? Why not just say, go all the way? Why not just make it universal and human? The goal of Judaism, he writes, is accomplished when it is reached by all of mankind. Right? Judaism, the Tanakh, is in some sense a universal book. But because the goal is not essentially the teaching of noble ideals, which would be rather easy and ineffective, but their realization in history, one has to start with the smallest unit of living reality within which the deed of Judaism can become history-making, and such a unit is the nation. Individuals may teach, but a people is needed in order to do effectively. Now, of course, the Torah says that we will be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. This is the fundamental sort of national statement that we find in the Torah about what we're supposed to be. Obviously, the questions that then arise are trying to interpret, well, what would that mean in real life? And here Berkowitz also goes on. Okay? A holy nation, he writes, is a realm in which all are priests, right? A kingdom of priests. But where all are priests, all are servants, and God alone rules. Okay? The idea of a kingdom of priests has an upward view, but also has a downward view. It says there is no religious hierarchy under sovereign circumstances. Where everyone is a priest, the only one in charge, really, is God. A kingdom of priests and a holy nation, he writes, is therefore not a theocracy, but a God-centered republic. Now, this is itself requires a lot of development. And he was not a theology wonk, if I can use that term. He did not go into publishing policy papers on what exactly every specific part of economic policy and military policy and so forth should be. But the fundamental concept was, we need a country, because only with our state of our own can we fulfill Judaism. Which is very, very different from saying, if we have a state, then the Messiah is going to come. And it's very, very different from saying, if we have a state, then we'll save Jewish lives, and that's a mitzvah. It's a recalibration of Judaism, much of the kind that we discussed upstairs earlier on. In order to fully understand where this is coming from, of course, you need to know that Berkowitz had a very specific view of Jewish history. And he, following his Rebbe, Rabbi Akiva Glasner from Pressburg, he really had a very radical take, something that is similar to part of what Rabbi Lopez Cardoza spoke about earlier on today, when he talked about the Rambam, about what has happened to Jewish tradition. Because in Berkowitz's view, the tremendous dynamic vitality of Jewish tradition began under sovereign circumstances, and it continued even after the destruction of the Second Temple, all of this huge, creative, incredible impetus that created the Talmud, all of that flowed from a recent tradition of sovereign life. Creativity is the result of having your own life. And it's intuitively true as well. When you feel you're in control of your financial reality and your physical security, then you can be more creative and more confident. When your entire life is built upon the constant struggle for survival, the constantly needing to give what is due to the powers that be to make sure your community keeps living, then all of your creativity becomes skewed and stunted. In Berkowitz's view, something went wrong in the medieval period. Something went wrong. It began in the 9th, 10th century period of the Geonim when the first lists of rules, the first codifications of halakha came out. And he believed that there was a real problem with this development over a period of centuries from a dynamic, constantly moving idea of Jewish law to one in which it was all about texts, it was all about lists of rules, it was all about the Mishneh Torah and the Shulchan Aruch. he called it halacha in a straitjacket. With the people, he wrote, the Torah too went into exile. The living Torah needs the dialectical tension and the confrontation with a total reality that asks questions and presents problems. Torah is alive when it meets the challenge, struggles with the problems, and seeks for solutions. When, through the Jewish emancipation, European Jews entered the circle of modern civilization and experienced the conflict between that new world and their Jewish world of old, the rigidity which they had taken upon themselves during the medieval period resulted in an inability to adapt, rendering all the important problems arising of that conflict insoluble. Jews began to share more and more in a life that was rapidly changing, while at the same time they remained in a spiritual and religious world that had lost its capacity to develop. And in such a situation, all attempts at reconciliation were doomed to failure. In other words, you want to know why the Enlightenment came and 90% of Jews abandoned their commitment to Torah? It's because Torah had stopped being something that could deal with the changes in the world. It used to be. And it had frozen in place and had ossified through this process of codification. In the context of the Holocaust, Berkowitz writes, and not the Holocaust, the first half of the 20th century, Berkowitz basically says, so much of Judaism has been abandoned. The only hope for the future of Judaism is to restart those engines through the creation of a Jewish state. So the Jewish state... So if morality and ethics are our way of evolving the law to make it responsible to life on the individual level, sovereignty and Zionism are a way of evolving the law and evolving Judaism to make ourselves responsible on a collective level. And then came the Holocaust. When I say and then came the Holocaust, obviously the Holocaust happened before statehood. But in Jewish theology, the Holocaust didn't happen in 1939 to 1945. In Jewish theology, it happened in the mid-60s when finally people started talking about the Holocaust. The Holocaust, well, I mean, there were a few books written during the war, and they were all kind of sort of traditional, sort of, you know, the Holocaust is because of Jewish sins, or it's because of the sins of the nations. In the 1960s, you see a wave of writing, all of it in English, all of it written by people who, and I'm not talking about Primo Levi, Elie Wiesel, I'm not talking about literary, I'm talking about theological writing proper, all of whom did not experience really the Holocaust. I speak carefully, because Emil Fackenheim was in a camp of some kind for a few months early, before the Holocaust started as such. He was released. But by and large, the great majority of Holocaust theology was written by people who were sitting in America during that period. And the thrust of the question of the Holocaust was, can we still believe in God? Can we still accept the classic covenant? The Holocaust is just so bad. Okay, we know. We had pogroms, and we had the Black Death, and we had all of these horrible things that happened, and somehow we managed to keep this belief in God, you know, Ela shebekol dor vador kamim aleinu l'chalotinu v'kadosh baruch hu matzilenu miyadam, right? In the Seder, we say that every year. Every generation, they rise up to get us, and God saves us from their hands. And after the Holocaust, in the mid-1960s, you have a string of Jewish writers who say, not now. Not this time. This is just too much. And so you have Arthur Cohen writing a book called The Tremendum. Tremendum has theological resonance back to Rudolf Otto in the 20s, who wrote about holiness as being this mysterium tremendum, this big, you know, mystery. Arthur Cohen, it's the Holocaust that's the theological tremendum now, not holiness. For Richard Rubenstein, he took the death of God movement from the what they call radical theologians in the Christian side, who were borrowing from Nietzsche the idea that God was dead. So Richard Rubenstein says God is dead. Holocaust proves that God is dead. Of course, he flipped it into a Zionist move. He said God is dead, therefore we're the only ones left to take care of ourselves, and therefore we need a state. Interesting. Emil Fackenheim created a 614th commandment, saying that it is now a commandment not that we may not give Hitler any posthumous victories. But at the same time, it was clear that he saw the Holocaust as being, you know, God didn't really do his end of the deal, so we're going to do even more. And even somebody like Yitz Greenberg, Rabbi Irving Greenberg, who wrote in the early 70s that the whole Holocaust upends the relationship between Israel and the divine. Berkovitz can't handle this. I mean, he can handle it, but he can't handle it. Okay, he feels on the one hand, how can you not recognize the depth of this question? How can you, of course, there's a huge theological question here. And anybody who says otherwise, anybody who comes with an easy answer, is really not addressing this with sensitivity the human questions that arise from the Holocaust. On the other hand, he has a very broad, overarching theological view that ties back into the question of responsibility. To deal with the Holocaust, he starts with the following observation. He says, the first thing we need to do is recognize that we thinking Jews, we are not the Holocaust victims. Somebody who is there, somebody who survived it, that they are in a different category. You can't touch that. It doesn't matter if they started out religious and see the Holocaust as a reason to stop being religious, or they started out secular and found their faith because of the Holocaust. Anybody went through that, that's something that we, on the one hand, will never be able to tap into. And on the other hand, because we weren't there, we also have an obligation to step outside of it and to think about it. This is very different from, say, somebody like again, Yitz Greenberg, who wrote that any statement that is not made, as if that could not be made in the presence of the burning children, those are his words, does not qualify as a legitimate Jewish statement. Berkovitz tries to go the other way. He says, no. We need to bracket out the direct experience of the Holocaust if we want to have anything to say to future generations. If we want to have anything to say from the standpoint of classic tradition, we have to step one step away from it. And he uses the model of Job, Eov. Okay, he says, in the presence of the holy faith of the crematoria, the holy faith of the crematoria, meaning people who were there who became religious, the ready faith of those who are not there is vulgarity. But the disbelief of the sophisticated intellectual in the midst of an affluent society, in the light of the holy disbelief of the crematoria, that's obscenity. We are not Job, and we dare not speak and respond as if we were. We are only Job's brother. We must believe because our brother Job believed, and we must question because our brother Job so often could not believe any longer. This is not a comfortable situation, but it is our condition in the era after the Holocaust. In it alone do we stand at the threshold of an adequate response to the Shoah, if there be one. It must come without the desecration of the holy faith or of the holy loss of faith of the Jewish people in the European hell. Now, the first step, once we take that step back from the abyss and can relate to the Holocaust as something, and it's doing this very, I mean, now it's a little bit perhaps even easier to say because so few of us saw it ourselves. But at the time he's writing in the early 70s, it was very difficult to say. But as soon as we take that step back, we have to understand the following very difficult statement, which is that to say the Holocaust is something entirely alien to us that we've never seen before is simply untrue. It might be bigger quantitatively, but it's not different theologically. It might be different philosophically because the modern world was built on the belief that such a thing could never happen again, and that progress had come, and that Europe was moving forward, and that science would solve all our problems. And the entire idea of mass slaughter on such a scale was completely unthinkable to the great majority of European philosophers who were sure that some kind of a utopia was on the way. But for Judaism, Berkowitz insists, this is not as new as it might sound. It is true, of course, that in the magnitude of suffering and degradation, nothing equals the tragedy of the German death camps. Yet the problem of faith of the survivors of any of those earlier catastrophes was not different from the problem which confronts us in our days. Surely there was no comfort for them in the fact that they had not known Auschwitz. Did the Jews massacred in the Rhinelands in the 11th and 12th centuries have less reason to ask where God was while those horrors descended upon them than the Jews at Auschwitz and Treblinka? Was the problem of faith in a personal God less serious during the Black Death than it is today, because then only half of the 500,000 Jews of Europe perished, and not 6 million as in our days? While in absolute terms, the horrors of the German death camps by far surpassed anything that preceded it, in terms of subjective experience, the impact of the catastrophe on the major tragic occasions of Jewish history was no less intense than the impact of the horrors of our own experience. While the Holocaust is unique in the objective magnitude of its inhumanity, it is not unique as a problem of faith resulting from Jewish historical experience. Indeed, one might say that the problem is as old as Judaism itself. All of this is just a setup before we get to the answer of what to do with God in the Holocaust. The first statement, of course, that Berkowitz is perhaps most famous for is that in studying the Holocaust, the first question that comes out of our mouths should not be where was God, but where was man? Man is responsible for what happens in this world. And in fact, the first half of his book, Faith After the Holocaust, is a story about what happened to Europe and how did Europeans develop such an animosity and such a hatred of Jews that they allowed themselves later on, whether secular or religious, Christians that is, to undertake the Holocaust. Now, in dealing with the theological question, Berkowitz presents a response that looks like something that is known in theology as the free will defense. The free will defense, or if you're a football fan, the free will defense. The free will defense says, to the question of, is it theoretically possible for an omnipotent, omniscient, and omnibenevolent God to allow any human suffering on this earth? Sounds like a contradiction. If God knows everything and controls everything and is all good, then nobody should ever suffer, and certainly not something like the Holocaust. To this question responds the theologian Alvin Plantinga, yes, it is possible. It is possible if you understand that free will is part of being good. And in order to allow human beings free will, this omniscient, omnipotent, omnibenevolent God must allow for freedom, and therefore must allow for people to do bad things, and therefore must allow for bad things to happen. Now, Berkowitz's response looks a little bit like this, and for this he was attacked. A number of different scholars, Stephen Katz was the most, from Boston University, was probably the most eloquent, where he says, you know, Berkowitz, if that's your answer, I just as soon give up freedom. I'm real, real happy to just not have free will and not have Auschwitz. But Berkowitz, I believe, was misread. Because for Berkowitz, the fundamental basic issue of humanity is not freedom. It's responsibility. Freedom is a tool. Freedom is a precondition of responsibility. But the purpose of creation is to make man like God. To make man who can create, to make man who can take responsibility. Man's freedom, he writes, must be respected by God himself. God cannot, as a rule, intervene whenever man's use of evil displeases him. It is true, if he did so, the perpetration of evil would be rendered impossible, but so would the possibility for good also disappear. Man can be frightened, but he cannot be bludgeoned into goodness. If God did not respect man's freedom to choose his course in personal responsibility, not only would the moral good and evil be abolished from the earth, but man himself would go with them. For freedom and responsibility are of the very essence of man. Without them, man is not human. If there is to be man, he must be allowed to make his choices in freedom. And the question is therefore not why is there undeserved suffering, but why is there man? He who asks the question about injustice in history really asks, why a world? Why creation? This is a difficult answer for the Holocaust. But difficult does not mean that there is a better one out there. It's an answer that we have to work with because there are no answers that will satisfy. The Holocaust is an unthinkable and continues to be an unthinkable. But what we do see in his approach, and however you like it or dislike that particular answer and that particular question, what we end up with in Berkowitz's writing is a comprehensive approach to Judaism and to Jewish questions that around which this Archimedean point of responsibility continues to drive it and continues to be expressed itself in many, many different areas. Delineated its sources in the Bible and in the Talmud, shows how it works in halakha, shows how it works in theology, shows how it works in the idea of Zionism, distinguishing himself not just from Jewish philosophers, but from other philosophers, Eastern and Western thinkers, and building for himself what I think is a fascinating, crucial, and as yet still significantly unmined source of wisdom about our tradition. Thank you. We have time for questions? Yeah? Yeah. Just louder, so because. To draw the same distinction between freedom and responsibility that I drew a few minutes ago. Look, there could be the question of the fruit, right? The question of the fruit in the Garden of Eden is a question that is worthy of a tremendous amount of looking into, because here's a case where he says, don't do it. He says, well, I'm going to do it anyway, and then he gets kicked out. But it's really not at all clear. But he gets kicked out because he ate of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, which throws the entire story upside down, right? Because it means that humanity got to knowledge of good and evil through illicit means. And it looks like that's a good thing. I mean, maybe. Right. Well, right. Okay. So there is some bizarre combination of, on the one hand, being charged with responsibility, and on the other hand, that responsibility requires the presence of freedom, and freedom requires the possibility of doing wrong, and doing wrong is the... Without doing wrong, there is no knowledge of good and evil. So I prefer to look at that story less as a lesson and more as a description. Again, and I mentioned this before in my previous talk, the opening chapters of Genesis are about explaining the relationship, the nature, the foundations, and the relationships between God, creation, and humanity, and the fundamental natures of how these things work. If that's the case, then the Garden of Eden story is a description of, look at this creature, man, charged with responsibility, he all of a sudden has freedom, and that's how he gets to good and evil. Maybe there is no responsibility with evil without evil, without the possibility of evil, which is essentially Berkowitz's underlying argument about the Holocaust. Very, I like that. Yeah.
In the end, that's what it's all more what it's all about. And they in effect, God didn't ask them to do that. It's something that they chose to put themselves into the complexity of this world, and maybe in the end, in more style or something like that. What is the book that you wrote about Berkowitz? Is that published or just written?
It is an as yet unpublished doctoral dissertation, about which more perhaps later. You can email me at davidhazzoni@gmail.com. Yeah. Thank you. Well, I want to just remind you that he did not use the word democracy. He used the word God-centered republic. And republic is a much more ancient, I mean, democracies are also ancient, but the concept of republic is a concept in which there's an idea of citizenship, an idea of the individual that is much, much more heightened than the idea that people are just under others. The Tanakh has a hierarchy of ritual, but not of religion. Anybody can become a Navi. Pretty much anybody can become a king. The only thing that people can't become are priests, and by and large, the Tanakh stories do not paint the priests that well. Okay, you have Hophni and Pinchas, you've got Nadav and Avihu, you've got Eli HaKohen, you've got this recurring, constant theme that priests range between impotent and corrupt. So, I wouldn't call that description of what there was as to be a hierarchy of religion or even spirituality. It was a hierarchy of ritual of sacrifice. And it was a hierarchy that stemmed in large part because the Levium were of a very specific character type. And a character type as manifest in the Torah that might be better off being placed in the places where purity and ritual is the focus and not warfare and sovereign judgment. What? He talked about in the end of Faith After the Holocaust, which is written right after. Most of it was written before the 73 war, and some of it right after. But it was written very much in the wake of 67. He talked about the possibilities of renewed sovereignty and the possibilities of some kind of a. He didn't go into the details of sacrifice and what the Mikdash would look like, but clearly he's there, along with so many other people back then at that particular time. He was in that moment, and he did see 67 as a tremendous redemption. I mean, how could you not? Where it would end up going eventually, he didn't go that far. Yeah. Why didn't he? That's a very good question. I think there are a few reasons that he did not become popular yet. One is that he was in Chicago. Now you will notice that not that there's anything wrong with that. Some of my best friends are in Chicago. Rav Arn from was in Chicago. I wouldn't say that Rav Arn became the most popular Jewish philosopher of the 20th century either. Okay. In fact, Berkowitz and Rav Arn had their own issues with each other. It's not like being in New York. It's just not. Okay, Berkowitz did not have a major Jewish center, institutional center, that he was the leading, considered the leading light of. He didn't have a JTS, he didn't have a YU, he didn't have a Hebrew Union College, he didn't have any of these. So I think part of it is that. Part of it, a second part was, he insisted on sitting in the back of the shul. Okay, he really, really did not play the game. And what? I don't want to say whether or not the Sri Eish played the game. I think that's something you should take up with Mark Shapiro, who's the world expert on Rabbi Chaim Yaakov Weinberg. I think Shapiro might say something very different. Yeah. Berkowitz was, look, he, He was, I mean, we've seen what the speeches of a very bold Orthodox thinker today with Rabbi Lopez Cardozo. Okay, Berkowitz didn't like to play the game. He called as he saw it, and that got him into trouble sometimes. He was not at all happy with the way halakha in its present, in its form at its time, dealt with women's issues. And later in his life, he actually became kind of bitter. And that comes out. The Jewish Women in Time and Torah is his last book. And you sense an impatience in his last couple of books, his last two books, really. You sense an impatience. You sense a sense of he no longer has the patience to spell out his positions in as careful and as respectful a manner as he might have once done. And Jewish Women in Time and Torah, it comes out pretty strongly. So I'm not surprised that he got in trouble specifically for that book. He wasn't happy with the state of the rabbinate. I mean, I'll take it one step further. For all of his discussion of Zionism as bringing, you know, these ancient categories, he addresses in his first book, 1943, 5 years before the State of Israel is founded, he's writing a book called Towards Historic Judaism, in which he lays most of this out in its initial form. And he addresses the issue of, should we have a new Sanhedrin? Turns out there's a lot of people in the early 40s talking about the possibility of restarting the Sanhedrin. And he says as follows, despite everything I've said about Judaism, we don't need a new Sanhedrin. Okay, why don't we need a new Sanhedrin? Because our rabbis are just nowhere near there. Okay, they simply do not have the tools required to speak with wisdom about the challenges facing a Jewish state. And it would be a tremendous mistake to entrust Jewish law to the current crop of rabbinic leaders. So he was not playing the game. Yeah. I'm not aware that he tried to establish a yeshiva in Israel. His son did establish a place called Beit Av, named after his father. I mean, Beit Av, right? And I'm sure that was not Berkowitz's name. His big institutional effort in his life was to try in the Hebrew Theological College in Skokie, his dream, and this is where the Rav Aaron stuff comes into play, his dream was to recreate what they had at the Hildesheimer Seminary in Berlin. The idea was you have a yeshiva where all the guys in the yeshiva, while they're getting smicha, are also pursuing a doctorate. And he, as far as I'm aware, led an effort to come up with, to reach agreements with local universities, I think it was Northwestern, to create such a program. And just before it started, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik came in and said, not in my Beis Medrash. And that was the beginning of what turned into a very significant struggle between the two figures that ended with trying to go to Beit Din about it, and that never really happened, and it just ended up being a certain kind of lasting acrimony. Yeah. Right, right. Right, that was a deliberate wink. Mordechai Kaplan was the only Jewish thinker who merited not one but two essays by Berkowitz, and one of them was pro and one was con. Different aspects. What he liked about Kaplan was, I think, was his worldliness and his concept of being in the world, and the Judaism is about, you know, and the idea, I mean, the whole idea of like the JCC and like all aspects of human life, he liked that. But the Reconstruction, he was not into, no. Thank you very, very much.